He wondered for a second, only a second, if he'd been reincarnated, and this was some leftover memory flittering down like ash. Then he picked up his bike and banished the idea. He wasn't 10. He started pedaling. His right hip knotted, his arm sizzling with the scrape from the corn. Maybe he'd get a good bruise, too. Deandra would like that. She'd brush one soft fingertip over it, circle it once or twice, and give it a poke so she could tease him when he jumped. She was a girl who liked big reactions, Deandra. She was a screamer, a weeper, a howler when she laughed. She made her eyes go wide, her brows almost up to her hairline, when she wanted to seem surprised. She liked to jump out from behind doors and scare him so he'd pretend to chase her. Deandra, his girl with a name that made him think of princesses or strippers, he wasn't sure which. She was a little of both, rich but sleazy. Something had rattled loose on his bike. There was a sound like a nail in a tin can coming from somewhere near his pedals. He stopped a second to look, his hands pink and wrinkled in the cold like an old man's, and just as weak, but could see nothing wrong. More blood pooled into his eyes as he willed himself to find the problem. Fuck, he was useless. He'd been too young when his dad left. He never had a chance to learn anything practical. He saw guys working on motorcycles and tractors and cars, the insides of the engines looking like the metal intestines of an animal he'd never seen before. Now, animals he did know, and guns. He was a hunter, like everyone else in his family, but that didn't stand for much since his mom was a better shot than he was. He wanted to be a useful man, but he wasn't sure how to make that happen, and it scared him shitless. His dad had come back to live on the farm for a few months this summer, and Ben had been hopeful, figuring the guy would teach him something after all this time, bother to be a father. Instead, Runner just did all the mechanical stuff himself. Didn't even invite Ben to watch. Made it clear, in fact, that Ben should stay out of his way. He could tell Runner thought he was a pussy. Whenever his mom talked about needing to fix something, Runner would say, "That's men's work," and shoot a smile at Ben, daring Ben to agree. He couldn't ask Runner to show him shit. Also, he had no money. Correction. He had $4.30 in his pocket. But that was it for him, for this week. His family had no money saved. They had a bank account that was always just short of empty. He'd seen a statement once where the balance was literally $1.10. So at one point, his entire family had less in the bank than what he was carrying in his coat right now. His mom couldn't run the farm right. Somehow she was screwing it up. She'd take a load of wheat over to the elevator in a borrowed truck and get nothing, less than what it cost to grow it. And whatever money she did get, she owed. "The wolves are at the door," his mom always said. And when he was younger, he pictured her leaning out the back door, throwing crisp green cash at a pack of hounds, them snapping it up like it was meat. It was never enough. Was anyone going to take the farm away at some point? Shouldn't someone? The best thing might be to get rid of the farm. Start all over fresh. Not tied to this big, dead, living thing. But it was his mom's parents' place, and she was sentimental. It was pretty selfish when you thought about it. Ben worked all week on the farm, and then went back to the school on weekends to work his crap janitor's job. School and farm and school, that's all his life was before Deandra. Now he had a nice triangle of places to go. School and farm and Deandra's big house on the edge of town. He fed cattle and hauled manure at home, and pretty much did the same at school, cleaning locker rooms and mopping the cafeteria, wiping up other kids' shit. And still he was expected to turn over half his paycheck to his mom. Family share. Yeah? Well, parents take care of their children. How about that one? How about not squirting out three more kids when you could barely afford the first one. The bike clattered along, Ben waiting for the whole thing to go to pieces like some comedy routine, some cartoon where he ended up pedaling on just a seat and a wheel. He hated that he had to bike places like Opie going to the fishing hole. He hated that he couldn't drive. Nothing sadder than a boy just short of 16, Trey would say, shaking his head and blowing smoke toward him. He said this every time Ben showed up to Deandra's on his bike. Trey was mostly cool, but he was the kind of guy who always had to get a jab in at another guy. Trey was 19, with long hair, black and dull like week-old tar, Deandra's step-cousin or something weird like that, great-uncle or family friend or stepson of a family friend. He either changed his story a few times, or Ben wasn't paying close enough attention. Which was entirely possible, since whenever he was around Trey, Ben immediately tensed up, got way conscious of his body. Why was he standing with his legs at that angle? What should he do with his hands? On his waist or in his pockets? Either way felt weird. Either way would lead to jokes. Trey was the kind of guy that would look for something just slightly but truly wrong about you that you didn't even notice and point it out to the whole room. "Nice high waters," was the first thing Trey ever said to him. Ben was wearing jeans that were maybe, possibly, half an inch too short. Maybe an inch. "Nice high waters." Deandra had screeched at that. Ben had waited for her to stop laughing and Trey to start talking again. He'd waited 10 minutes, saying nothing, just trying to sit at an angle where his socks wouldn't peek out too much. Then he'd retreated to the bathroom, unlooped his belt a notch, pulled the jeans down near his hips. When he came back to the room, Deandra's downstairs rec room, with blue carpet and beanbags everywhere like mushrooms, the second thing Trey ever said to him was, "Your belt's down to your dick now, man. Ain't fooling no one." Ben rattled down the trail in the cold shade of winter, more flakes of snow floating in the air like dust motes. Even when he turned 16, he wouldn't have a car. His mom had a Cavalier that she bought at an auction. It had once been a rental car. They couldn't afford a second one, she'd already told Ben that. They'd have to share, which immediately made Ben not want to use it at all. He already pictured trying to pick up Deandra in a car that smelled of hundreds of other people. A car that smelled completely used. Old French fries and other people's sex stains. And on top of that, a car that was now cluttered with girls' school books and yarn dolls and plastic bracelets. That wouldn't work. Deandra said he could drive her car. She was 17. Another problem, because wasn't that sort of embarrassing to be two grades below your girlfriend? But that was a much better vision. The two of them in her red CRX with its jacked-up rear end, Deandra's menthol cigarettes filling the car with perfumey smoke, Slayer blasting. Yeah, much better. They'd drive out of this crap town to Wichita, where her uncle owned a sporting goods store and might give him a job. Ben had tried out for both the basketball and football teams and been cut early and hard. In a don't-come-back sort of way, so spending his days in a big room filled with basketballs and footballs seemed ironic. Then again, with all that equipment around, he might be able to practice, get good enough to join some men's league or something. Seemed like there must be a plus side. Of course, the biggest plus side was Deandra. He and Deandra, in their own apartment in Wichita, eating McDonald's and watching TV and having sex and smoking entire packs of cigarettes in a night. Ben didn't smoke much when Deandra wasn't around. She was the addict. She smoked so much, she smelled like tobacco even after a shower. Like if she slit her skin, menthol vapor would ooze out. He'd come to like it. It smelled like comfort and home to him, the way warm bread might to someone else. So that's how it would be. He and Deandra, with her brown spirally curls all crunchy with gel, another smell that was all her, that sharp, grapey sting of her hair, sitting on the sofa, watching the soap operas she taped every day. He'd gotten caught up in the drama. Big-shouldered ladies drinking champagne with diamonds flashing from their fingers while they cheated or their husbands cheated or people got amnesia and cheated. He would come home from work, his hands smelling of that dusty basketball leather smell, and she'd have bought his McDonald's or Taco Bell, and they'd hang out and joke about the spangly ladies on TV. And Deandra would point out the ones with the nicest nails. She loved her nails. And then she'd insist on painting his, or putting lipstick on him, which she loved to do. She loved to make him pretty, she always said. They'd end up in a tickle fight on the bed, naked with ketchup packets smashed to their backs, and Deandra would monkey laugh so loud the neighbors would bang on the ceiling. This image wasn't quite complete. He'd deliberately left out one very frightening detail, just completely erased certain realities. That can't be a good sign. It meant the entire thing was a daydream. He was an idiot kid who couldn't even have something as small as a shitty apartment in Wichita. Not even something as tiny as that could he have. He felt a surge of familiar fury. His life was a long line of denials, just waiting for him. Annihilation. Again, he saw axes, guns, bloody bodies smashed into the ground, screaming, giving way to whimpers and birdsong. He wanted to bleed more.
Libby Day, now. When I was a kid, I lived with Runner's second cousin in Holcomb, Kansas, for about 5 months while poor Aunt Diane recuperated from my particularly furious 12th year. I don't remember much about those 5 months, except that we took a class trip to Dodge City to learn about Wyatt Earp. We thought we'd see guns, buffalo, whores. Instead, about 20 of us shuffled and elbowed into a series of small file rooms looking up records, the entire day packed with dust motes and whining. Earp himself made no impression on me, but I adored those Old West villains with their dripping mustaches and slouchy clothes and eyes that glowed like nickel. An outlaw was always described as a liar and a thief. And there, in one of those inside-smelling rooms, the file clerk droning on about the art of archiving, I jiggled with the good cheer of meeting a fellow traveler. Because I thought, that's me. I am a liar and a thief. Don't let me into your house. And if you do, don't leave me alone. I take things. You can catch me with your string of fine pearls clickering in my greedy little paws, and I'll tell you they reminded me of my mother's, and I just had to touch them, just for a second, and I'm so sorry. I don't know what came over me. My mom never owned any jewelry that didn't turn her skin green, but you won't know that. And I'll still swipe the pearls when you're not looking. I steal underpants, rings, CDs, books, shoes, iPods, watches. I'll go to a party at someone's house. I don't have friends, but I have people who invite me places. And I'll leave wearing a few shirts under my sweater, with a couple of nice lipsticks in my pocket, and whatever cash is floating inside a purse or two. Sometimes I even take the purse, if the crowd is drunk enough. Just sling it over a shoulder and leave. Prescription pills, perfume, buttons, pens, food. I have a flask someone's granddad carried back from World War II. I own a Phi Beta Kappa pin earned by some guy's favorite uncle. I have an antique collapsible tin cup that I can't remember stealing. I've had it so long, I pretend it's always been in the family. The actual stuff my family owned, those boxes under my stairs, I can't quite bear to look at. I like other people's things better. They come with other people's history. One item in my home I didn't steal is a true crime novel called Devil's Harvest, The Satan Sacrifice of Kinnickey, Kansas. It came out in 1986, and was written by a former reporter named Barb Eichel, and that's all I really know. At least three semi-boyfriends have given me a copy of this book, solemnly, wisely, and all three of them were dumped immediately after. If I say I don't want to read the book, I don't want to read the book. It's like my rule about always sleeping with the light on. I tell every man I sleep with that I always keep the lights on, and they always say something like, "I'll take care of you, baby," and then try to switch off the lights. Like, that's that. They somehow seem surprised that I actually sleep with the lights on. I dug out Devil's Harvest from a leaning stack of books in the corner. I keep it for the same reason I keep the boxes of my family's papers and crap, because maybe I'll want it someday, and even if I don't, I don't want anyone else to have it. The opening page read, "Kinnicky, Kansas, in the heart of America, is a quiet farming community where folks know each other, go to church with each other, grow old alongside each other. But it is not impervious to the evils of the outside world. And in the early hours of January 3, 1985, those evils destroyed three members of the Day family in a torrent of blood and horror. This is a story not just of murder, but of devil worship, blood rituals, and the spread of Satanism to every corner of America, even the coziest, seemingly safest places." My ears started their hum with the sounds of that night. A loud, masculine grunt, a heaving, dry throat wail, my mother's banshee screams, dark place. I looked at the back page photo of Barb Eichel. She had short, spiky hair, dangling earrings, and a somber smile. The biography said she lived in Topeka, Kansas, but that was 20-some years ago. I needed to phone Lyle Worth with my money for info proposal, but I wasn't ready to hear him lecture me again about the murder of my own family. "You really think Ben's guilty?" I needed to be able to argue with him instead of sitting there like some ignoramus with nothing useful to say, which is basically what I was. I scanned the book some more, lying on my back, propped up on a twice-folded pillow, Buck monitoring me with watchful kitty eyes for any movement toward the kitchen. Barb Eichel described Ben as a black-clad loner, unpopular and angry, and obsessed with the most brutal form of heavy metal, called black metal. Songs rumored to be little more than coded calls to the devil himself. I skimmed, naturally, until I found a reference to me. Angelic, but strong. Determined and sorrowful. With an air of independence that one usually doesn't find in children twice her age. Our family had been happy and bustling, looking forward to a future of clean air and clean living. Still, this was supposedly the definitive book on the murders, and after all those voices at the Kill Club telling me I was a fool, I was eager to speak with an outsider who also believed that Ben was guilty. Ammo for Lyle. I pictured myself ticking off facts on my fingers. This, this, and this proves you jackasses are wrong, and Lyle unpursing his lips, realizing I was right after all. I'd still be willing to take his cash, if he wanted. Not sure where to start, I called the Topeka directory, and most beautiful bingo ever, got Barb Eichel's number. Still in Topeka, still listed. Easy enough. She picked up on the second ring, her voice merry and shrill, until I told her who I was. "Oh, Libby, I always wondered if you'd ever get in touch," she said, after making a throat sound like "eh-eh." "Or if I should reach out to you. I didn't know. I didn't know." I could picture her looking around the room, picking at her nails, skittish. One of those women who studied the menu 20 minutes and then still panicked when the waiter came. "I was hoping I could talk to you about Ben," I started, not sure what my wording should be. I know, I know. I've written him several letters of apology over the years, Libby. I just don't know how many times I can say I'm sorry for that damn, damn book. Unexpected. Barb Eichel was going to have me over for lunch. She wanted to explain to me in person. She didn't drive anymore. Here I caught a whiff of the real story. Meds. She had the shiny coating of someone on too many pills. So I'd come out to her, and she'd be so grateful. Luckily, Topeka's not far from Kansas City. Not that I was eager to go there. I'd seen enough of it growing up. The town used to have a hell of a psychiatric clinic. Seriously. There was even a sign on the highway that said something like, "Welcome to Topeka, psychiatric capital of the world." The whole town was crawling with nutjobs and therapists, and I used to get trucked there regularly for rare, privileged outpatient counseling. Yay for me. We talked about my nightmares, my panic attacks, my issues with anger. By the teenage years, we talked about my tendency toward physical aggression. As far as I'm concerned, the entire city, the capital of Kansas, smells like crazy house drool. I'd read Barb's book before I went to meet her, was armed with facts and questions. But my confidence was flattened somewhere in the 3 hours it took to make the 1 hour drive. Too many wrong turns, me cursing myself for not having the internet at home, not being able to just download directions. No internet, no cable. I'm not good at things like that. Haircuts or oil changes or dentist visits. When I moved into my bungalow, I spent the first 3 months swaddled in blankets because I couldn't deal with getting the gas turned on. It's been turned off 3 times in the past few years, because sometimes I can't quite bring myself to write a check. I have trouble maintaining. Barb's house, when I finally got there, was dully homey, a decent block of stucco she'd painted pale green. Soothing. Lots of wind chimes. She opened the door and pulled back like I'd surprised her. She still had the same haircut as her author photo, now a spiky cluster of gray, and was wearing a pair of eyeglasses with a beaded chain, the type that older women describe as funky. She was somewhere north of 50, with dark, darting eyes that bulged out of a bony face. "Oh, hi, Libby," she gasped, and suddenly she was hugging me. Some bone of hers poking me hard in my left breast. She smelled like patchouli and wool. "Come in, come in." A small rag dog came clicking across the tiles toward me, barking happily. A clock chimed the hours. "Oh, I hope you don't mind dogs. He's a sweetheart," she said, watching him as he bounded up on me. I hate dogs, even small, sweet dogs. I held my hands aloft, actively not petting it. "Come on, Weenie, let our friend get by," she baby-talked it. I disliked it even more after I heard its name. She sat me down in a living room that seemed stuffed. Chairs, sofa, rug, pillows, curtains, everything was plump and round and then layered with even more material. She bustled in and out a bit, calling over her shoulder instead of standing still, asking me twice what I wanted to drink. Somehow I knew she'd try to give me dirt-smelling, crystal-happy earthen mugs of beebleberry root tea or jasmine elixir smoothie, so I just asked for water. I looked for liquor bottles, but couldn't spot any. There were definitely some pills being swallowed here, though. Everything just plinked off this woman. Bing-bang! Like she was shellacked. She brought sandwiches on trays for us to eat in the living room. My water was all ice cubes. I was done in 2 swallows. "So how is Ben, Libby?" she asked when she finally sat down. She kept her tray to her side, though, allowing for a quick retreat. "Oh, I don't know. I don't have contact with him." She didn't really seem to listen. She was tuned to her own inner radio station, something light jazz. "Obviously, Libby, I feel a lot of guilt over my part in this. Although the book came out after the verdict, it had no bearing on that, she said in a rush. Still, I was part of that rush to judgment. It was the time period. You were so young, I know you don't remember this, but the 80s. I mean, it was called the Satanic Panic. What was? I wondered how many times she'd use my name in conversation. She seemed like one of those. The whole psychiatric community, the police, law enforcement, the whole shebang. They thought everyone was a devil worshiper back then. It was trendy. She leaned toward me, her earrings bobbing, her hands kneading. People really believed there was this vast network of Satanists, that it was a commonplace thing. A teenager starts acting strange, he's a Satan worshiper. A preschooler comes home from school with a weird bruise or an odd comment about her privates. Her teachers are Satan worshipers. I mean, remember the McMartin preschool trial? Those poor teachers suffered years before the charges were dropped. Satanic Panic. It was a good story. I fell for it, Libby. We didn't question enough. The dog sniffed over to me, and I tensed up, hoping Barb would call it away. She didn't notice, though, her eyes on a dangling stained glass sunflower casting golden light from the window above me. And I mean, the story just worked, Barb continued. I will now admit, and it took me a good decade, Libby, that I breezed over a lot of evidence that didn't fit this Ben Satan theory. I ignored obvious red flags. Like what? Like the fact that you were clearly coached. That you were in no way a credible witness. That the shrink they had assigned to you, to, quote, draw you out, was just putting words into your head. Dr. Bruner? I remembered Dr. Bruner, a whiskery hippie dude with a big nose and small eyes. He looked like a friendly storybook animal. He was the only person besides my Aunt Diane I liked that whole year, and the only person I talked to about that night since Diane was unwilling. Dr. Bruner. Quack, Barb said, and giggled. I was about to protest, feeling defensive. The woman had basically just called me a liar to my face, which was true, but still pissed me off. But she was going again. And your dad's alibi? That girlfriend of his? No way should that have held. That man had no real alibi, and he owed a lot of people a lot of money. My mom didn't have any money. She had more than your dad did, believe me. I did. My dad once sent me to a neighbor's house for a free pity lunch, told me to look under their sofa cushions and bring him any change. And then there was a footprint of a men's dress shoe in blood that no one ever traced. But then again, the entire crime scene was contaminated. That's something else I skipped over in the book. There were people going in and out of that place all day. Your aunt came in and took out whole closets of junk, clothes and stuff for you. It was all against any rules of police procedure. But no one cared. People were freaking out. And they had a strange teenage boy that no one in the whole town liked that much, who had no money, who didn't know how to look out for himself, and who happened to like heavy metal. It's just embarrassing. She checked herself. It's awful. Tragedy. Can anything get Ben out? I asked, my stomach gone eely. The fact that the definitive voice on Ben's guilt had changed her mind was sickening me. As was meeting yet another person who was positive I'd committed perjury. Well, you're trying to, right? I think it's almost impossible to undo these things after all these years. His time for an appeal, per se, is up. He'd need to try for habeas corpus, and that's... You all would need some big new evidence at this point to get the ball rolling, like some really compelling DNA evidence. Unfortunately, your family was cremated, so... Right, well, thank you, I interrupted, needing to get home. Right then. Again, I wrote the book after the verdict, but if I can do anything to help you, let me know, Libby. I do bear some culpability. I take that responsibility. Have you made any statements? Told the police you don't think Ben did it? Well, no. It seems like most people concluded a long time ago that Ben didn't do it, Barb said, her voice going shrill. I assume you've officially recanted your testimony? I think that'd be a huge help. She was waiting for me to say more, to explain why I'd come to her now, to tell her, yeah, sure, Ben was innocent and I was going to fix all this. She sat, eyeing me, eating her lunch, chewing each bite with excessive care. I picked up my sandwich, cucumber and hummus, and set it back down, leaving a thumbprint in the damp bread. The room was lined with bookshelves, but they contained only self-help books. Open the sunshine. Go, go, girl. Stop punishing yourself. Stand up, stand tall. Be your own best friend. Moving on, moving up. They went on and on. The relentless, cheerful, buck-up titles. The more I read, the more miserable I felt. Herbal remedies, positive thinking, forgiveness of self, living with mistakes. She even had a book for beating tardiness. I don't trust self-helpers. Years ago, I left a bar with a friend of a friend, a nice, cute, crew-necked, normal guy with an apartment nearby. After sex, after he fell asleep, I started nosing around his room and found that his desk was covered with sticky notes. Don't sweat the small stuff. It's all small stuff. If only we'd stop trying to be happy, we'd have a pretty good time. Enjoy life. No one gets out of here alive. Don't worry. Be happy. To me, all that urgent hopefulness was more frightening than if I'd found a pile of skulls with hair still attached. I ran out in full panic, my underwear tucked up a sleeve. I didn't stay much longer with Barb. I left with promises to call her soon and a blue paperweight in the shape of a heart I stole from her side table.
Patty Day, January 2, 1985, 9:42 a.m. The sink was stained a sludgy purple from where Ben had dyed his hair. Sometime in the night, then, he'd locked himself in the bathroom, sat down on the closed toilet seat, and read through the instructions on the carton of hair color she'd found in the trash. The carton had a photograph of a woman with light pink lips and jet black hair, worn in a pageboy. She wondered if he'd stolen it. She couldn't imagine Ben, chin-to-chest Ben, setting a dye kit on the checkout counter. So he'd shoplifted it. Then in the middle of the night, her son, all by himself, had measured and combined and lathered. He'd sat with that mud pile of chemicals on his red hair and waited. The whole idea made her incredibly sad, that in this house of women, her boy had colored his hair in the night by himself. Obviously, it was silly to think he'd have asked her for help, but to do such a thing without an accomplice seemed so lonely. Patty's older sister, Diane, had pierced Patty's ears in this bathroom 2 decades ago. Patty heated a safety pin with a cheap lighter, and Diane sliced a potato in half and stuck its cold, wet face against the back of Patty's ear. They froze her lobe with an ice cube, and Diane, "Hold still, hold still," jabbed that pin into Patty's rubbery flesh. Why did they need the potato? For aim or something. Patty had chickened out after the first ear, had plopped down on the side of the bathtub, the lancet of the pin still sticking out of the lobe. Diane, intense and unbudging in a mountainous wool nightgown, closed in on her with another hot pin. "It'll be over in a second. You can't do just one, P." Diane, the doer. Jobs were not to be abandoned, not for weather, or laziness, or a throbbing ear, melted ice, and a scaredy kid sister. Patty twirled her gold studs. The left one was off-center, her fault for squirming at the last minute. Still, there they were, twin markers of teenage brio. And she'd done it with her sister. Just like she'd first applied lipstick or hooked elastic clips to sanitary napkins the size of a diaper circa 1965. Some things were not meant to be done alone. She poured Comet into the sink and started scrubbing, the water turning an inky green. Diane would be by soon. She always dropped in midweek if she was in her car, which was her way of making the 30-mile drive out to the farm seem like just part of a day's errands. Diane would make fun of this latest Ben saga. When Patty was worried about school, teachers, the farm, Ben, her marriage, the kids, the farm. After 1980, it was always, always, always the farm. It was Diane she craved, like a stiff drink. Diane, sitting in a lawn chair in their garage, smoking a series of cigarettes, would pronounce Patty a dope, would tell her to lighten up. Worries find you easily enough without inviting them. With Diane, worries were almost physical beings, leechy creatures with latch hooks for fingers, meant to be vanquished immediately. Diane didn't worry. That was for less hardy women. But Patty couldn't lighten up. Ben had gone so remote this past year, turned himself into this strange, tense kid who walled himself into his room, kicking around to music that rattled the walls, the belchy screaming words seeping out from under his door. Alarming words. She'd not bothered to listen at first. The music itself was so ugly, so frantic. But one day she'd come home early from town, Ben thinking no one was home. And she'd stood outside his door and heard the bellows. I am no more. I am undone. The devil took my soul. Now I'm Satan's son. The record skipped, and again came the coarse chant. I am no more. I am undone. The devil took my soul. Now I'm Satan's son. And again. And then again. And Patty realized Ben was just standing over his record player, picking up the needle and playing the words over and over like a prayer. It was Diane she wanted here. Now. Diane settled down on the couch like a friendly bear in one of her three old flannel shirts, now chewing a series of nicotine gums, would talk about the time Patty came home in a mini dress, and their folks actually gasped, as if she were a lost cause. And you weren't, were you? You were just a kid. So is he. And Diane would snap her fingers like it was that simple. The girls were hovering outside the bathroom door. They'd be out there when she emerged, waiting. They knew from Patty's scrubbing and mutterings that something further had gone wrong, and they were trying to decide if this was a situation for tears or recrimination. When Patty cried, it invariably set off at least two of her girls, and if someone got in trouble, the house got windy with blame. The day women were the definition of mob mentality. And here they were on a farm with plenty of pitchforks. She rinsed her hands, chapped, red and hard, and glanced at herself in the mirror, making sure her eyes weren't wet. She was 32, but looked a decade older. Her forehead was creased like a child's paper fan, and crow's feet rayed out from her eyes. Her red hair was shot with white, wiry threads, and she was unattractively thin, all bumps and points, like she'd swallowed a shelf's worth of hardware, hammers and mothballs and a few old bottles. She did not look like the kind of person you'd want to hug, and in fact her children never snuggled into her. Michelle liked to brush her hair, impatiently and aggressively, the way Michelle did most things, and Debbie leaned into her whenever they were both standing, loosely and distractedly, as was Debbie's way. Poor Libby tended not to touch her at all, unless she was really hurt. And that made sense, too. Patty's body had been so used up that by her mid-twenties, even her nipples were knobby. She'd bottle-fed Libby almost immediately. There was no medicine cabinet in the cramped bathroom. What would she do when the girls hit high school? One bathroom for four women? And where would Ben be? She had a quick, miserable image of him in some motel room, all by himself in a boy mess of stained towels and spoiled milk. So she kept a small cluster of toiletries stacked along the sink. Ben had shoved all the containers into one corner. Aerosol deodorant and hairspray. A midget can of baby powder she didn't remember buying. They were now splattered with the same violet stain that dirtied her sink. She wiped them down like they were china. Patty wasn't ready for another trip to the department store. She'd driven to Selena a month ago in a positive, bright mood to pick up some prettifying items. Cream rinse, face lotion, lipstick. She had folded a $20 bill in her front pocket just for the trip. A splurge. But the sheer amount of options in face cream alone, hydrating, wrinkle-fighting, sun-thwarting, had overwhelmed her. You could buy one moisturizer, but then you had to get a matching cleanser, too, and something called toner. And before you were even ready for the night cream, you'd have blown $50. She'd left the store with nothing, feeling chastened and foolish. "You've got four kids. No one expects you to look like a daisy," was Diane's response. But she wanted to look like a daisy every now and then. Months back, Runner had returned, just dropped out of the sky with a tan face and blue eyes, and stories of fishing boats in Alaska and the race circuit in Florida. He'd stood on her doorstep, lanky in dirty jeans, with not even a wink about the fact they hadn't heard from him in 3 years, hadn't gotten any money from him. He asked if he could board with them till he got settled. Naturally, he was broke, although he handed Debbie half a warm Coke he'd been drinking as if it were a wonderful gift. Runner swore he'd fix things up around the farm and keep it all platonic, if she wanted. It was summer then, and she let him sleep on the couch, where the girls would run to him in the morning as he lay sprawled and stinky in torn boxers, his balls half out. He charmed the girls. He called them baby doll, angel face. And even Ben watched him attentively, swooping in and out of interactions like a shark. Runner didn't exactly engage Ben, but he tried to joke with him a little, be friendly. He'd include Ben as a male, which was good. He'd say things like, "That's a man's job," and give Ben a wink. After the third week, Runner rolled up in his truck with an old fold-out sofa he'd found and suggested he camp out in the garage. It seemed okay. He helped her with dishes and he opened doors for her. He'd let Patty catch him looking at her butt and then pretend to be embarrassed. They'd exchanged a smoky kiss one night as she was handing him clean bed sheets, and he'd immediately been on her, hands up her shirt, pressing her against the wall, pulling her head back by her hair. She pushed him off, told him she wasn't ready, tried to smile. He sulked and shook his head, looking her up and down with pursed lips. When she undressed for bed, she could smell the nicotine from where he'd grabbed her just below the breasts. He'd stayed another month, leering around, starting jobs and leaving them half done. When she asked him to leave during breakfast one morning, he called her a bitch, threw a glass at her, left juice stains on the ceiling. After he was gone, she discovered he'd stolen $60, two bottles of booze, and a jewelry box that he'd soon discover had nothing in it. He moved to a decrepit cabin a mile away. Smoke came from the chimney at all times, the only form of heat. Sometimes she could hear gunfire in the distance, the sounds of bullets shot straight up in the air. That would be her last romance with the man who fathered her children. And now, it was time for more reality. Patty tucked her hair, dry and unwieldy, behind her ears, and opened the door. Michelle sat on the floor right in front of her, pretending to study the floorboard. She assessed Patty from behind gray-tinted glasses. "Spent in trouble?" she asked. "Why'd he do that? With his hair?"
"Growing pains, I think," Patty said. And just as Michelle took a deep breath, she always gulped air before she said something. Her sentences were tight, fast links of words that just kept coming till she had to breathe again. They heard a car coming up the driveway. The driveway was long. Someone would pull onto it, and they wouldn't arrive for another minute. Somehow, Patty knew it wasn't her sister, even though the girls were shrieking, "Diane! Diane!" already, running toward the window to look out. There'd be sad little sighs when it wasn't Diane after all. Somehow she knew it was Len, her loan officer. Even his driving had a possessive sound to it. Len, the lechy lender. She'd been wrangling with him since 1981. Runner had left by then, announcing this kind of life wasn't for him. Looking around like it was his place instead of hers, her parents, her grandparents. All he'd done was marry her and ruin it. Poor, disappointed Runner. When his dreams had been so high in the 70s, when people actually thought they could get rich from farming. "Ha!" she snorted out loud, there in her kitchen, at the thought of it. Imagine. She and Runner had taken over the farm from her parents in 74. It was a big deal. Bigger even than her marriage or the birth of her firstborn. Neither of those had thrilled her sweet and quiet parents. Runner stank of trouble even then. But bless them, they never said a thing against him. When, at age 17, she told them that she was knocked up and they were getting married, they just said, "Oh," like that, which said enough. Patty had a blurry photograph of the day they took on the farm, her parents stiff and proud, smiling shyly at the camera, and her and Runner, triumphant grins, bountiful hair, incredibly young, holding champagne. Her parents had never had champagne before, but they drove to town and got a bottle for the occasion. They toasted out of old jelly jars. It went wrong fast, and Patty couldn't entirely blame Runner. Back then, everyone thought the value of land would keep skyrocketing. They're not making any more of it. And why not buy more and better all the time? Plant fence post to fence post. It was a rallying cry. Be aggressive. Be brave. Runner, with his big dreams and no knowledge, had marched her down to the bank. He'd worn a tie the color of lime sherbet, thick as a quilt, and hemmed and hawed to get a loan. They'd ended up with double what they asked for. They shouldn't have taken it, maybe. But their lender said, "Don't worry. Boom times." "They're just giving it away," Runner had howled. And all of a sudden, they had a new tractor and a six-row planter when the four-row was fine. Within the year, there was a glinting red Krauss Dominator and a new John Deere combine. Vern Evely, with his respectable 500 acres down the way, made a point of mentioning each new thing he spotted on their property, always with a little twitch in his eyebrow. Runner bought more land and a fishing boat. And when Patty had asked, was he sure? He'd sulked and barked about how much it hurt that she didn't believe in him. Then everything went to hell at once. It was like a joke. Carter and the Russian grain embargo. Fight the commies, forget the farmers. Interest rates to 18%. Price of fuel creeping up and then leaping up. Banks going bust. Countries she barely heard of. Argentina suddenly competing in the market. Competing with her back in Little Kinnicky, Kansas. A few bad years and Runner was done. He never got over Carter. You heard about Carter all the time with him. Runner'd sit with a beer watching the bad news on TV, and he'd see those big rabbit teeth flash and his eyes would go glassy. He'd get so hateful it seemed like Runner must actually know the guy. So Runner blamed Carter, and everyone else in the rotten town blamed her. Vern Evely made a noise with his tongue whenever he saw her, a for-shame noise. Farmers who weren't going under never had sympathy. They looked at you like you played naked in the snow and then wanted to wipe your snotty nose on them.
Just last summer, some farmer down near Ark City had his hopper go screwy. Dumped 4,000 pounds of wheat on him.
This 6-foot man, he drowned in it. Suffocated before they could get him out. Like choking on sand. Everyone in Kinnicky was so mournful, so regretful about this freak accident, till they found out the man's farm was going under. Then all of a sudden it was, well, he should have been more careful. Lectures on taking proper care of equipment, being safe. They turned on him that fast, this poor dead man with lungs full of his own harvest. Ding dong, and here was Len, just as she dreaded, handing his wool hunting cap to Michelle, his bulky overcoat to Debbie, carefully swiping snow from loafers that were too shiny new. Ben wouldn't approve of those, she thought. Ben spent hours grubbing up his new sneakers, letting the girls take turns walking on them, back when he let the girls near him.
Libby glowered at Len from the sofa and turned back to the TV. Libby loved Diane, and this guy wasn't Diane. This guy had tricked her by walking in the door when he should have been Diane.
Len never said hello as a greeting. He said something like a yodel, "Hello," and Patty had to brace for it each time. She found the sound so ridiculous. Now he yelled it as she walked down the hall, and she had to duck back into the bathroom and curse for just a second, then put her smile back on. Len always hugged her, which she was pretty sure he didn't do with any other farmer that needed his services. So she went to his open arms and let him do his hug thing where he held her just a second too long, his hands on both her elbows. She could feel him making a quick sucking noise, like he was smelling her. He reeked of sausage and velaments. At some point, Len was going to make a real pass at her, forcing her to make a real decision, and the game was so pathetic it made her want to weep. The hunter and the hunted. But it was like a bad nature show. He was a 3-legged runt coyote, and she was a tired, limping bunny. It was not magnificent.
"How's my farm, girl?" he said.
There was an understanding between them that her running the farm by herself was something of a joke, and she supposed it was at this point. "Oh, hanging in there," she said. Debbie and Michelle retreated to their bedroom. Libby snorted from the couch. The last time Len had come all the way to the house, they'd had an auction a few weeks later. The days peeking out through the windows as their neighbors underpaid and underpaid some more for the very equipment she needed to run a working farm. Michelle and Debbie had squirmed, seeing some of their schoolmates, the boiler girls, tagging along with their folks as if it were a picnic, skipping around the farm. "Why can't we go outside?" they whined, twisting themselves into begging angry outlines. Watching those boiler girls taking turns on their tire swing. Might as well have sold them that, too. Patty had just kept saying, "Those aren't our friends out there." People who sent her Christmas cards were running their hands over her drills and disc rippers, all those curvy, twisty shapes, grudgingly offering half what anything was worth. Vern Evely took the planter he once seemed to resent so much, actually driving the auctioneer down from the starting price. Merciless. She ran into Vern a week later at the feed store. The back of his neck went pink as he turned away from her. She'd followed him and made his for-shame noise right in his ear.
"Well, it sure smells good in here," Len said, almost resentfully. "Smells like someone had a good breakfast."
"Pancakes." She nodded. "Please don't make me ask you why you're here. Please, just once, say why you came."
"Mind if I sit down?" he said, wedging himself on the sofa next to Libby, his arms rigid.
"Which one's this?" he said, assessing her.
Len had met her girls at least a dozen times, but he could never figure out who was who, or even hazard a name. One time he called Michelle Susan.
"That's Libby."
"She's got red hair like her mom."
"Yes, she did." Patty couldn't bring herself to say the nicety out loud. She was feeling sicker the longer Len delayed, her unease building into dread. The back of her sweater was moist now.
"The red come from Irish? You all Irish?"
"German. My maiden name was Kraus."
"Oh, funny. Because Kraus means curly-haired, not red-haired. You all don't have curly hair, really. Wavy, maybe."
"I'm German, too." They had had this conversation before. It always went one of two ways. The other way, Len would say that it was funny, her maiden name being Kraus, like the farm equipment company, and it was too bad she wasn't related, huh? Either version made her tense.
"So," she finally gave in, "is there something wrong?"
Len seemed disappointed she was bringing a point to the conversation. He frowned at her as if he found her rude.
"Well, now that you mention it,
yes.
I'm afraid something's very wrong. I wanted to come out to tell you in person. Do you want to do this somewhere private?"
He nodded at Libby, widening his eyes.
"You want to go to the bedroom or something?"
Len had a paunch. It was perfectly round under his belt, like the start of a pregnancy. She did not want to go into the bedroom with him.
"Libby, would you go see what your sisters are doing? I need to talk to Mr. Warner."
Libby sighed and slid off the couch, slowly. Feet, then legs, then butt, then back, as if she were made of glue. She hit the floor, rolled over elaborately a few times, crawled a bit, then finally got to her feet and slumped down the hall. Patty and Len looked at each other, and then he tucked his bottom lip under and nodded.
"They're going to foreclose."
Patty's stomach clenched. She would not sit down in front of this man. She would not cry.
"What can we do?" "We, I'm afraid, are out of options. I've held them off for 6 months longer than they should have been held off. I really put my job on the line, farm girl."
He smiled at her, his hands clasped on his knees. She wanted to scratch him. The mattresses started screeching in the other room, and Patty knew Debbie was jumping on the bed, her favorite game, bouncing from one bed to the next in the girls' room.
"Patty, the only way to fix this is money. Now. If you want to keep this place, I'm talking borrow, beg, or steal. I'm saying time is over for pride. So, how badly do you want this farm?"
The mattress springs bounced harder. The eggs in Patty's belly turned. Len kept smiling.
Libby Day, now. After my mother's head was blown off, her body axed nearly in two, people in Kinnicky wondered whether she'd been a whore. At first they wondered, then they assumed, then it became a loose jingle of fact. Cars had been seen at the house at strange times of night, people said. She looked at men the way a whore would. In these situations, Vern Evely always remarked that she should have sold her planter in 83. As if that was proof she was prostituting herself. Blame the victim, naturally. But the rumors turned so substantial. Everyone had a friend who had a cousin who had another friend who'd fucked my mom. Everyone had some bit of proof. They told of a mole on the inside of her thigh, a scar on her right buttock. I don't think the stories can be true. But like so much from my childhood, I can't be sure. How much do you remember from when you were 7? Photos of my mother don't reveal